Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, how are you doing? I nearly said hello, darling. I can call you darling. Hello, darling. How are you doing? How is your day going so far? Are you listening in the morning as I am recording this? It's morning time. It's 10 to 11. Or maybe it's afternoon where you are now, or even evening, or even night. I listen to quite a lot of podcasts at night, actually. I sometimes find it a little bit hard to drop off. So I've been listening to a lot of podcasts that just to drop off. I'm trying to think what I've been listening to at the moment. Oh, I'm listening to, I don't know if you will have listened to this episode, but I spoke, must have been last year, to a BBC journalist called Helena Merriman. And we had a lovely chat, but she does a brilliant podcast called Room 5, which I've been listening to. I think it was published. I don't think I'm listening to them as they're published. I think it just finished its series, but there was a couple I missed, so I've been listening to some of them. I've also been listening to Hannah Fry's science podcast, which I really like. And just being kept company. So where are you right now? What are you up to? Have you had a productive day today? Well, no matter how much of it you've been up for. For me, at nearly 11, it's been okay. I took the kids to school this morning. It's starting to get a bit cold out there. I hear it's in for another cold snap this week. Not quite the kind of -3 we had before Christmas, but we might be heading for like not that far above zero, which quite frankly, I'm not happy about. Coats, yes. Gloves and hats, no. I'd rather not, thanks. Especially in the mornings. I have to get the kids out the door. My eldest 2 leave the house by 7:30, 7:40 latest. And then the next 2, I walk them to school and we leave at about 8:30. And Mickey as well, if he's got nursery that day, which is most days now. And, you know, it's still a bit dark. It's still a bit cold. It's been a bit rainy. Yeah, it's just much easier when the sky is blue. Actually, after all my complaining about the weather, today's been a nice sunny day. And what else has been going on? Well, I'm having quite a quiet start to the new year. But it's very much kind of calm before the storm because I know I'm about to do things like the artwork for my album and a video for the album. So the album's coming out in the early summer and I'm doing a shoot next week for the cover art and I can't wait. And I've got a really cool idea and I'm hoping it all comes to fruition as I see it in my mind's eye. Because if it does, then I think you're going to love it. And I don't know what I've shared with you already. So basically the album, I started writing it just before I took a trip in 2020 with my mum and my eldest boy, Sunny, and we went to Tokyo. So the album kind of had a sort of idea of what that trip would be about, both in terms of seeing Japan for the first time, but also traveling with my family. But that you know, those three generations. So that was kind of the groundwork of it. So I want the artwork to reflect that. So you'll have to wait and see, I guess. But yeah, hopefully we've got a really cool thing. And I've recorded some of my radio show this week, my kitchen disco that I do for BBC Sounds, which is always a lovely thing to do because it's just putting together lots of lovely party music. And the other thing I've been doing is firing off emails left, right and centre to people that I think would be good for the pod. Oh, I've got some corkers. I'm so excited. I've been thinking about, you know, what professions I think would be really interesting to hear, you know, combined with parenthood. And I think I've got some really good ones for you. I even asked the kids, actually, and they had a good idea. So I followed that lead as well. So wait and see, but let's see if it all comes together. But feeling good. Not to mention, I've already recorded, well, actually, the majority of this series is already done. I've got the other dates in the diary. So, you know, feeling good. And the nice thing is that so often with the conversations for the podcast, in fact, I did one this week, and I come away from a lot of the chats feeling really energized, quite focused, because a lot of the women I speak to end up being, they're quite dynamic and quite go-getter. And then sometimes I just get very nice and sort of soothed and comforted, like with the guest I've spoken to for this week, which is Keris Matthews. And I'm sure you're very familiar with Keris's voice, but she's got such a beautiful Welsh accent and the melody that accompanies that accent. There's a lovely melodic quality to Welsh. It's just very, very soothing. So that was a joy. We spoke on Zoom. I'm not 100% certain I've ever actually met Keris in the flesh, although we will have definitely been in the same rooms at the same time, because Keris, you know, her singing career, her music career, was at its peak with Catatonia when The Audience, my first band, was starting out. So I was always sort of aware of Keris. And, you know, the music was actually pretty inescapable in the sort of late noughties. And not about late noughties, late 90s, I meant to say. Got my decades muddled up. You know, very much the sound of that time. And I always really liked Keris and thought she was interesting. So I kind of kept an eye on her when she went solo after the band split up and went to Nashville and did albums like Cocker Hoop and went more to the folky side of things. And then with her radio career, because she currently broadcasts on radios 2, 4 and 6. And we listened to her on our 6 music show. And it's lovely. And if you haven't listened to it, I really recommend it. So Keris has got 3 kids, 2 boys, 1 girl. They're now all teenage. She lives geographically not that far from me. So I'm in West London. She's in West London, but we spoke on Zoom. And it was really lovely. We do talk a little bit about Christmas because it was just in the build-up to Christmas. It was in December that we chatted. So I hope you can handle your Christmas chat in January. But yeah, she's just got such a beautiful way of talking and thinking about things. Oh, and we also spoke about her new book she's done, which is a children's, was with children in mind, an adaptation of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood with beautiful illustrations. So check that out. It's gorgeous. And I did read it to my littlest one, actually. It's quite a good bedtime book because Dylan Thomas's words, again, they just flow. It's completely lovely. So yeah, settle down. Maybe it might be a good cup of tea chat, this one, and or like a warm coffee or a, you know, hot chocolate or something. It's definitely the audio equivalent. And I will see you on the other side. Thank you for your time.
No.
We can have a lovely chat, and thank you so much. I've been really looking forward to speaking to you today.
Same.
So why don't we start with the here and now? What are you up to at the moment? Tell me everything.
Well, it is the 1st of December when we're talking, and this time of year, it starts sort of, time starts pelting quite yes. a lot. So I make radio shows. Primarily at the moment, that's what I do. And you have to do double shows in order to be able to put enough in the bank for you to stop. I mean, in terms of recorded material, not money. It's enough for you to stop over Christmas. So I'm in full on Christmas mode as it is.
And you curate all of your own shows, don't you? You do all of it yourself.
Yeah.
So that's a big labour of love, a big passion.
It is. It's brilliant. And especially with one particular streaming platform, which is Spotify, it's so fast. You can reference so many songs and keep ahead of new releases so much faster than before, where you're, well, I'm still, you know, you're still like juggling different formats and of vinyl and CDs and then WAV files that come through via, you know, email and stuff. So it's quite interesting, actually, but how much faster it's got recently.
Yeah.
And I love that, but it does quite often end up with being cross-eyed a bit because you're staring and
overwhelming,
scrolling so many songs. So sometimes I go, oh, okay, I've got to stop and do something else.
Yeah, I just need to do something else.
Yeah.
And tell me about Under Milk Wood, because the book arrived this week and it's absolutely beautiful.
Were you familiar with it?
Yes, I did it at school, probably like a lot of people actually. But I forgot how beautiful Dylan Thomas's language is. It's just mesmeric, actually. You sort of get into this little trance of it. It's just beautiful.
Because did you go to school in England?
I did, yeah.
Do you know what? I grew up in Swansea. So if you know Swansea, it's got a very wide crescent-shaped bay. And it runs to the Mumbles, and there's a pub run as well in Mumbles. But anyway, I never studied Dylan Thomas at school. So
oh, really?
When people,
I thought it was a
no. Thing. So like when people like yourself say, "Yeah, we did it in school," I was like, "Oh, you lucky things!" I didn't. So it's quite funny. So it took me until I had my, well, I was pregnant with my first child, Glennis, who's now 19, and I found a little miniature of A Child's Christmas by Dylan Thomas on a Christmas tree when I was living out in South Carolina. Like, so it's pretty late on finding Dylan Thomas, especially growing up where he grew up, exactly with the same view. And I just was like you say, the way he writes and the images that just bubble up in your mind when you read his work and the things that stay in your mind. He's the kind of writer, in the same way I think as, say, James Joyce and Ulysses or the works of Robert Burns or Langston Hughes, that they have phrases that kind of stick quite easily in your mind.
Yeah.
And you run along your life with these lines and it makes, you know, humdrum a little more rich when you think about them or when you're reminded of them. And so, yeah, I fell in love with Dylan Thomas's work at that point. And then since then, I've sort of been catching up and I love putting this together.
It's funny you say that about the language sort of running alongside, because even now, if it's a nice morning, then it pops into my head about Rosy Fingered Dawn. And I think there's lots of things like that where they have this sort of like, I think that came from Homer, and that was sort of the same thing. It was like a long piece that's designed to be memorized. So you have these little drop points, little drop anchors that are designed to kind of help you. If you were reciting it, they would be like, these are the bits of repetition.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And they just stay with you, don't they? When you see a nice
really
dawn,
do.
That comes straight into your mind and it makes you feel good somehow.
Yeah. And I think the whole thing of Dylan Thomas is this Under Milk Wood. I didn't realise as well, because when I got the book, I kind of looked again at the history of that. And I didn't realise he was writing it from when he was young all the way up to just before he died. And he didn't finish the last bit of the poem until it was just about to be performed for the first time.
Yeah, until the curtains are about to be raised. Yeah,
how incredible
and
that
he started writing it when he was at school, you know, as a child himself. But then he did write some of his big hitting poems as a teenager, you know, the really heavy, intense ones. And if you visit his house, which you can do, it's been renovated back to 1940s in Cwmdonkin Park in Swansea. If you visit there, you'll see his room's not much bigger than a single bed. It's literally the box room. And you think about this little tousled-haired boy with way too much energy and never liked going to school, but had an English teacher as a father, so he was devouring, you know, the classics, Dickens and Shakespeare and everything. And you can hear, once you start reading, and Proust as well, you can hear in his work, all these writers, once you start reading them, you're like, oh, okay, they're all reading each other's work. They're just like musicians, you know, they're like magpies.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, talking about that, so that takes you back to your own child. And funnily enough, my producer for the podcast, Claire Jones, she's from Mumbles.
Is she?
She is. So she talks about it really fondly. And it's interesting hearing you say that you actually discovered Dylan Thomas when you were pregnant with your first baby, because I always talk to people about what was happening in their life at that time. So you were in America. And how did that make you feel about home when you're somewhere else for a while, like when you're reflecting back to your childhood and the place where you came from?
Well, it does take you to, you know, it takes distance and time in order to really appreciate what elements make up what home is to you, or what things you value. Like, it took me living out in America for almost 6 years to really love this strange place called Britain, and things like the BBC, which simply you thirst for and hunger for when you're in a country like America. And it sort of really makes you suddenly reassess everything when you live quite far away for quite a long time, and especially when you start having children as well, and you think wherever they're going to be brought up, they are going to become part of that cultural norm and social norms that are held in that country. And so that all of that and many more things made me sort of come back to the UK to bring the children up. But yeah, so that's why with the Dylan Thomas stuff, I think, being so far away and reading this guy and realizing that, you know, time disappears when you read a great piece of work, and then it can be relevant to you in 2022, to him in 1940, to somebody living in, I don't know, a village in Taiwan or Cameroon, just as much as you identify with it, because ultimately they're talking about humanity and all of, like, all of our troubles and strife, but also the good things about life. Because when I was working on Under Milk Wood and trying to make it, because I didn't want to lose the, basically it's using Dylan Thomas's text, because you wouldn't want to change that. But I wanted it to be a bite-sized piece so that you didn't have to wait till you were older to read it. And so that I could share it with really young children as a bedtime story, because it's kind of perfect. It's 24 hours in the life of these wonderful people. And when I distilled it down, it sort of became obvious that it was a story about love and hope. I mean, he describes Llareggub as this place of love. And that's really what I want. When, you know, when you read something like Goodnight Moon.
Oh, yes.
Did you
I
read
love
that
Goodnight
one?
Moon.
I love that story.
We still read that.
Oh, there's something so innocent, but wise, but evergreen and powerful about that Goodnight Moon. And what you have together, again, it's about the phrases and the power of words and imagination and belonging and everything. And then you have that in common with your children. You know, good night bowl of mush, old lady whispering
good night, nobody.
Hush.
I like the good night nobody.
Spoon, good night cow jumping over the moon. I mean, you just carry them with you, and they carry it with them, and they hopefully will pass it on to their children. So in those magical moments, when hopefully you can down tools as a carer, and you're with this mind that hasn't yet had to deal with the complexities of the troubles and the injustice of the world, then that is such a untouched and potent moment to fill with these wonderful texts and wonderful writing and ideas and images that will never leave them. You know, and that they
That's
can pass
true.
On. And Under Milkwood, I think, is it just gave the opportunity to make a book like that for times like that. And it took me ages to persuade the owners of the rights to Under Milkwood to see. But I did an audio version of it, and they were like, okay, now we get it. Let's go.
Perfect. Oh, that's so lovely. And I love that what you're saying there as well about that thing when you, as you say, when your children are small and they're innocent to so much of, as you say, the sort of complexities and the sort of the stuff you know they're going to have to greet at some point in their life. But you've got that bit where they're just small and you can just layer in all these lovely, beautiful, exciting things that come from the words of, you know, people who've lived a life and experienced things, but they can still get through those really beautiful layers of, you know, the good stuff in life and art and poetry and imagination and possibility and excitement. You just sort of put as much of that in as possible.
And mischief, you know.
Yes, that's
like,
true.
You think about fairy tales as well. They're wicked. I mean, literally wicked. And they're scary and they've got evil in them and things. But when you're safe and you're in your duvet or when you're cuddled with your teddy bear and your mum or your dad or your carer or your uncle, your auntie, your brother, your sister, whatever is there with you, it's good you can feel all of the emotion, spectrum of emotions, you know, because you're safe. I think that's the difference. And that's what, so in Under Milkwood, I mean, there's so much detail in it because we had to cull down. I mean, it was horrible to do it. Some of the best, like, text, but we had to make it work so that a little one wouldn't lose interest. That would be the worst, you know. He had to keep it it was cherry picking, you know, but keeping the story.
No, you've done a beautiful job. It really works. And the illustrations.
Did your children like them? Have you read it to your children?
Yeah. My 10-year-old was looking through it this morning, actually. And he's an avid reader and he will definitely devour it. But I think as well, my 7-year-old will really like it. Actually, I might even try a bit of it with Mickey because I do a bedtime story with him every night. He's 3.
Yeah, oh, please do. Yeah. Because there's bits in it, like you mentioned, the illustrations are by Kate Evans. So she's based in Bristol. But her grandfather, that was weird. I didn't know this. So I picked her out because her work is quite old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be quite timeless, as is the story in a sense. And also deal with all the detail that we had to lose through the text. So you can go through the book and you'll find a woman with trotters as feet. Mm-hmm. And you'll find, you know, clouds of black flour, and you can find dandruff and nail pairings and bottle tops and buttons and ancient Welsh instruments flying around. All the detail that's in the text that we couldn't fit into a bedtime story, they're all in the illustrations. And the kids, they love pointing them like mice with gloves on and things.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so, all of that stuff. Those are the best things, aren't they, where you keep finding new things. It kind of reminded me a little bit of a sort of, My childhood memory of something like the Eleanor Rigby video, where there's lots of things happening and it's kind of got quirky little moments where you're kind of looking at the detail and trying to work it out. Because I like the fact that, as you say, I think what you said about feeling scared when you know you're safe is such a really, what's the word? It's quite a gleeful moment of childhood, actually. I used to always like that feeling. Like, I remember the first time I took one of my kids to a pantomime, it was a bit scary and he got a bit scared. And one of my mum's friend leant down to him and said, but isn't it nice being scared when you know you're safe, really? I thought, that's it. That's what that is. It's actually quite a nice feeling, isn't it? When you look at something and it's got a kind of quality to it that makes you feel a bit like a little shiver in a good way.
For sure. You've just reminded me of being in Billy Elliot. We went to see the theatre production of Billy Elliot. And I think my Johnny was going to be more than about 6, and I had to take him out of the auditorium because there was that sad bit when the ghost of the mother visits Billy.
Okay, you know what? I haven't actually seen that. I know I'm probably in the 2% of people who haven't seen Billy Elliot, but
no, it was really poignant moment and quite sad. And poor John is such a sensitive lad. He just was crying so much he was choking. He couldn't stop crying. He was so sad. Right. Ball him up in my arms and take him out and, you know, make sure he knew it was a theatre story, but then actually people are in heaven and it's fine, we'll all go to heaven hopefully, and, you know, all these kind of things to try and make him feel all right, because as a 6-year-old he's like, how come his mom is dead?
Yeah. No, really, I remember watching, do you know a film called The Champ? Do you remember The Champ? It's a boxing film.
Yeah.
And in that the dad dies, and I found that absolutely devastating. I think when you're small, the idea of a parent dying is just
it's horrifying.
I didn't realise that can happen, thanks.
Exactly. That's so now burst in your the
kids,
bubble.
Exactly. So are your kids, I was trying to work, are they 19 and 18 and 13? Is that right?
Pretty much 19, 17 and a half.
Okay.
And just turned 13, yes.
Okay, so you've got, it's funny because you're probably at a stage that when they were small you used to sort of think about, like, oh, one day there'll be a bit where they're all in their teens, because I know I sort of sometimes think ahead to how old they're going to be at certain points, and having them all in their teens is quite a significant bit, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. You're no longer on all fours trying to get food from the underside of tables and chairs and skirts and boots. You're more likely to be, like, getting phone calls saying, can you come and pick up so-and-so? do you know, I love having teenagers, but it is a total roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one minute you're like, oh, I love this. I love this so much. We can share clothes, or we're watching the same programs and the same level, and they're very funny, you know, and they're watching, giving me music to listen to and, you know, stuff to look out for and helping me with various, you know, new emerging trends and stuff. Then the next minute is complete breakdown,
mm-hmm.
because there's still, it's still quite raw, the world and everything that's going on, and they're like, then, so it's really an interesting roller coaster at the minute.
Yeah, well, my eldest two are 18 and 13, so I have a bit of that. In fact, that means we must have had our first babies around the same time. So 2004 was my eldest. So you must have been 2003. What was happening in your life at that time? Did you always want to have babies?
Yeah. I'm one of four, and I've always loved babies. And I like the riot and the rebellious nature of toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
There's no holding them back, is there? They're just absolutely wild.
And you're kind of rooting for them, even though you're also trying to get them to, you know, be where they need to be or do what you need to do or whatever. But you're kind of rooting for that, the rebelliousness. I'm always kind of like slightly on their side too. Like, yeah, sure, question everything. Why not?
Except for when you're on a long-haul plane.
Oh, there's loads of times where it's acceptable, but yeah.
Oh my gosh. Like the worst, my worst parenting experience was on a long-haul flight, because I was, at the time, I had two children in America, so living in South Carolina and then Tennessee, and most of my work was still in this country, so I was traveling back and forth with two children, both still in nappies, and there was one particular, and my children were motion sick a lot, and then you would be traveling as a single parent with two little ones, and everyone would be like, oh, they're so cute, you want a cookie, and they'd be eating the worst diet, and I was really, I didn't realize the value of a regimented diary, let's say. I didn't have any kind of routine whatsoever. Anyway, we'd be on a long-haul plane and they'd be eating all this sweet stuff, and then they were motion sick, so I'd always have to take extra pairs of clothing with me. But anyway, this one time I was so exhausted and I'd fallen asleep, and then there was a tap on my shoulder and it was like, ma'am, is that baby in the aisle, your baby? I'm like, oh, yes. And there was, the other child as well, looking everywhere. She was a toddler of two, you know, but she's all right. Wow. She's on the, anyway.
Well, that's impressive having the, I mean, that's like not a very big gap between them. And I guess, you know, nothing takes you into the moment, the here and now, like having very young children. Like you haven't got much time to, you're just kind of in it, aren't you, at that time? It's just your full whole on. World are those full days. On. Yes, full really on. Full on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
I don't know about you, but also, so I first became aware of you when I was in my first band. So I was in a band called The Audience, and you were so successful. Like, Catatonia were just everywhere. So I always used to look up to you and see what you were up to. And then I think my solo career was when Catatonia were having, actually, I think, because you, did you break up in 2001?
Yeah.
And then?
Yeah.
Okay, so same sort of time. So for me, when I had Sonny, my eldest, it was like everything I'd done before he was born suddenly became like part of this like old life, like old chapter. And it kind of almost made me start again a little bit in terms of thinking about what I wanted to do and where I wanted to head and what bits of my previous music and career were really important to me. Like, these are the bits I really have to, can't sacrifice. And then the other bits were like, I haven't got time for that anymore. Did you find it helped clarify things in that way, or was it a different thing for you?
That's an interesting question. I'd left the band before I went to America, and that kind of cleared the slate for me completely, because I decided at the time I saw it was probably a good decision to just start again, ground zero, and leave all of the hubbub of the band and sort of a nightlife behind. And I literally lived in a cabin in the woods with no running water or anything for the first year I was in America. That was in Tennessee and just outside of Nashville in a place called White's Creek.
What was that like then, that time? Was it kind of, did it feel really good to kind of go just to do something completely different like that?
Oh my gosh, it felt amazing. Like, it was really, I don't think back on it now, but because it was really a massive change in my life, a massive turning point. But it meant that I could just get rid of all of the sort of pressures of being a business as part of a band and touring constantly and losing my voice constantly and not really dealing very well with the attention, to say the least, to leaving all that behind and just getting back to the music.
That's amazing.
So I was living
in
the cabin. Well, but, I mean, that's probably quite selfish, actually, thinking back. And I do feel a bit guilty about that. But I had to do it for sanity's sake.
Yeah. But it's also very brave, because you're basically just going like, I know there's something in me that knows I need this. And actually, being selfish when it means that you can be in a better place afterwards is better for everybody. So I would argue there's like a real merit in that for everyone that knows you and loves you, actually. It's a good thing, isn't it, long term?
Yeah, I think you're more useful if you're able to be a positive addition to the world, you know.
definitely
rather than like a scattergun cannonball. So I went just to the US and found a tiny little rural place studio. I happened to find sort of solace in a place with Bob Dylan's pedal steel player, Bucky Baxter, who then kind of encouraged me, got my confidence back with songwriting, surrounded me with some of the, you know, emerging musicians in Tennessee at the time, as well as some of the big guns, Byron House and Richard Bennett, that play with the likes of Neil Diamond and Dolly Parton and people like that, and just literally just sit around fires and pick pick mandolins it was just the best thing ever. And then during that time as well, I was able to do, it was so good. You'd love it. I mean, any musician would love it. It was literally just saying, okay, let's go back to the basics. Let's just chase the music you love and go exploring. And then I went on loads of road trips, and I love, you know, jazz and blues. And so it gave me the chance to go into the swamps of Louisiana and hang out with Zydeco and Cajun musicians as well. So it's lovely now, coming back to the UK, that I'm able to share all of that as records that I bought with me on the radio shows, you know. So it makes sense now, but I didn't know what I was doing then.
Isn't that amazing how life can do that, where something you do ends up actually making a lot of sense? Because so much of what you've said, I can see, has really led you to this point. I mean, we love your radio show. Your Six Music show is part of our Sunday.
Oh, thank you.
I know,
so
it's
much.
It's so good. And I think I can really see, well, from the outside looking in, it seems like you're in a really good spot and very content. And just the way you could just pull in all these different elements and, I don't know, just sort of really sort of seep it all in, all the richness that's out there in the world. And like what you said before about, you know, the best, the art can be so incredible for joining up the dots of, as you say, what it is to be human and stories and perspective. And I've always, always loved that about music. But also I can really identify with what you're saying about when things are all in a swirl and suddenly your music career becomes part of a corporate angle.
Commodity.
And, yes. And suddenly the music and the stories you want to tell and the fun of it starts to really diminish, and you feel this sort of, I mean, I went through quite a lot of, I had quite a lot of panic attacks around, sort of, around 2000, 2001, when things were going a little bit fast. And I was a bit like, you don't really have a chance to process if it's even what you want, because everybody's so busy telling you that this is all the good stuff. And your diary is so busy. Isn't that wonderful? And you're a bit like, I don't know, is it? I haven't seen my family and friends for a while, and I don't really feel like I've got a lot of control over what's going on. I mean, I don't know if that's how you felt about it. That's how I perceived it at the time. Not the happiest, and really.
And being interviewed as well. And being held up to scrutiny.
Mm.
And I don't know about you, but I mean, the whole reason I love music and art is because I can lose myself in it and forget troubles and find solace and hope and all the rest of it. So to be stood and questioned on it and then have to share, I'm quite shy, you know. So it's really odd being questioned and made to think, you know. I find it quite, I feel like squirming a bit. And then you think about the old interviews you did, because you know, you do a lot of interviews when you're lucky enough to have, you know, chart success and stuff, don't you? And there was one day when I was in this really modern German hotel, which it was so modern that it had no soft furnishings at all. So it was a really rigid, really rigid bed, like a plastic blind. And I kid you not, it was like a sheet of metal as a desk and an industrial chair as a chair.
Wow.
And it was a brick wall that had been sort of raw, you know, the raw edge of the brick had been renovated. And then it was back-to-back interviews. You know, why did you write this song? What is this line about? Why do you think this? And then the whole day was like that. And I honestly, I was like, oh my goodness, this is so weird. This is just so weird. And in the room, everything was echoing as well. And it just felt so odd. But it is an odd way of making a living.
Definitely.
Really.
I think it's good to have that perspective, actually. Definitely. And I know as well that when I had kids, I really liked the fact that a lot of that stuff, I could clear out in my head making that stuff important. And I can now just sort of, like when something's a bit absurd, it's like, well, that's fine, because I go home to something that's very, very real.
Very real.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to, you asked me, and I give you a really long answer that didn't answer your question, but you asked about the effect of having children. And then from my perspective, they became an anchor. As soon as Glennis was born, there was an anchor, and all of a sudden there was the responsibility shifted that I had to make decisions, because now I had her to look after, and it made sense of everything.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? It's very powerful, that. And actually that thing of, I mean, there's lots of ways people can find anchors in their life, but yes, I think for me, the same thing. And I think, like you, I'm from quite a big family, and I think just having that around me makes me feel quite safe, actually. And I like the fact that it just turns any silliness in the outside world about my work side of things, it can just reduce that to, like, it just gives good perspective, basically, on lots of stuff, I think.
And you know, what you do as well, and what you've done with sharing that most noblest thing, which is love and trust and pure enjoyment of music together in a home with your kitchen discos is just exactly what, you know, that I think most of us realize that all of the headlines and the clickbaits and the celebrityness and all of this kind of thing is not really real, but that the real thing is who you surround yourself with on a daily basis. And we're not reminded of that because it doesn't make anyone any money, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not the frisson of excitement that is that untouchable thing that somehow humans can tend to gravitate to or want to worship at. But, you know, essentially for us all, I think it's those moments that really matter.
Yes, definitely.
You know, like Christmas, I think that's what makes Christmas, even if you're not Christian, so special, like year on year on year. It's like yeah. you're hoping that that you get the chance at at least one moment where it's all about community or relationships or, you know, that moment of belonging.
Yes, and having all the family around and, yeah, I love all that
too. Having eggnog.
Do you have everybody around to yours? Do you host it?
I did last year and I was in a right state. So I did. Do you know what? Let me tell you something. I have had a eureka moment this year.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is, like, you think about Christmas and as a host, you want to perpetuate all the things that you think make the best Christmas, mm-hmm. right? So you have to do, we don't eat meat, so you have to do Yorkshire puddings, you have to do the stuffing balls, mm-hmm. you do all of the things, the pickled cabbage, the cheap bread, what do you call it, bread sauce from packets that we always used to have. Everything has to be what it used to be in the, Swansea 1980s Christmas. Is you end up with a tiny little city oven trying to be cooking about 20 different not courses, but 20 different sides for one Christmas lunch, and it has to be the right, and then you end up knackered because you've already been working double shifts to get the radio shows in the bank ready to take the break. And then you're sort of 53 years of age, which is what I am now. And you've got all of that emotional, hormonal gear change going on as well. And then last year I was just like, I can't deal. And I had to go for a long walk, you know. So my eureka moment this year is, I'm a working person. I'm going to save up money and I'm going to buy a chef, like the services of a chef to come in, not on Christmas Day, but on the 28th of December. Oh my gosh, why haven't I thought of that before? I can't be chef and be a mom and be like a host and be, you know, everything, the shopper and be a working person and everything and make a really relaxed Christmas. Why has it taken me 25 Christmases to realise that actually at this point, why not get a professional in to help?
I was just going to say, it's amazing. It takes like, I mean, that means that, yeah, that's a good revelation, but you probably could have done with some of that like a decade ago. Like, just don't feel you have to be all things to all people all the time.
You know, and can you say that again?
So you don't have to feel like you have to be all things to all people all the time. But I think,
amen.
Yeah, it's a thing that it takes a while. And even when you say it out loud and believe it, you still end up trying a bit. And it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, apart from the packets of bread sauce and stuff, are there other ways that you've sort of tried to introduce elements of your own childhood with your, I mean, it must have been strange when you had your first kids and you were somewhere that wasn't the place where you grew up. Or did that really not really matter that much? I suppose it's just an adventure,
you know,
isn't it?
It is an adventure, but it gets quite serious when they're about school age and they're about to join the school system.
Mm.
What it really helped with, though, to be honest, was you really realise family, you know, and having help, how important that is.
Oh, yes, because when you're away, you don't have your relatives nearby, so...
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No. And also, you know, if you have time in nurseries and good nurseries and the help, the professional help in terms of, you know, nurseries and stuff, that you like going around with thank you so much. But with Christmas, yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag really, because basically everyone's got different Christmases, and we're a blended family now as well. So there's a whole lot of, so-and-so does a better Christmas. Oh, we do this in America. Oh, we do this in that house. So we do this. So it's like arguments over like when and how many presents you're meant to open up, what time of day and that kind of thing.
But, well, I grew up with two Christmases. It encouraged me to think of it as a season, not a day, which I think has been quite helpful.
I love that idea.
Yeah, because otherwise it's too stressful. It's just too stressful.
It's so stressful, and it's meant to be enjoyable.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I like the idea that it just doesn't all have to happen on that 25th.
Yes.
That actually, I prefer that lull, or the lead up to and then the lull after.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do for New Year's? Do you have a big to-do?
No, not really. I'm the biggest fan of New Year's. So my favourite is actually to be working or just at home with, like, fish and chips and telly on, because I don't really go to like a New Year's Eve party or something.
No,
it's too much pressure on the evening to be something. Also, if you go to a party, sometimes you've got midnight either seems like it comes around a bit early and you're not quite ready for that big woohoo, or it feels like it takes ages to get to that point, and then you're like, okay, now can we go? Depending on how good the night is, I guess. So, yeah, I've had a really mixed bag with New Year's. So I'm happiest, either working so I know where I've got to be and just get that and have some fun with that, or just at home, thank you. Yeah,
same.
It's not a big thing.
I always feel like the New Year should be like around springtime anyway.
Oh, yes.
Because that really feels like a beginning of a new year.
Also, I always feel a bit sad after New Year's Eve and it's all cold in January and you're like, everything feels a bit blue, doesn't it? Like, it doesn't make me fill me with optimism. But if there was little new buds,
we've got February to come.
Exactly. But if there was like spring and new buds on the trees, you'd be thinking, oh yes, new beginnings. I can do this. It's true. Spring's my favorite. I like spring a lot.
I do as well.
Just to ask you though, I was thinking, because you do for a living something that's also a passion and has been there since you were small, have you ever sort of struggled to give it space? Like, did it come easily to you to go back into work after you'd had your kids, or to work alongside raising them, or was it something that was quite tricky to give room to?
It is so tricky, and it's only just sort of stopped now with the kids being older that you can go, oh, there's food in the fridge. Do you mind? You know, you can cook now. They're really good cooks,
the older children.
Yeah, really good cooks. So that's cool. And I love cooking. So that's one thing thankfully, they've kind of been able to share and pick up on as well, because my mum loved cooking as well. But, who was it that said it years and years ago? Or maybe it was me, I don't know, but I want a wife.
Oh, when you said it to me in an email, you mean? And you said, next time I'm coming back as a man and I'm going to have myself a wife.
Did I say that in an email
you
to
did.
You?
You did. I was like, that's brilliant. It made me laugh out loud. That's, yeah, I was like, good
plan.
I know it's sexist
and it's of this era, but it still feels that way. It's like, it just still feels like the onus to keep the balls in the air. I don't know if it does in your household, but it certainly does in mine. And with my friends that are working people, it's a lot.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's I think that's very much how a lot of people feel. And of course you get relationships and dynamics in families that are different, but I definitely surprised myself by how traditional a lot of the roles are within my own family, that I didn't think I was going to fall into the same dynamic, because you have all the conversations about all the options that you have available to you, and yet I've still fallen into the same trap. And it's a tricky one, because sometimes I want to be across everything, because I don't want to let on the bits that I'm finding difficult or the fact that I'm struggling to keep up, because in my head I feel like a lot of other people are nailing all of it, so therefore I have to try and nail it too. So
yeah, and especially that's what you're seeing when people share these perfect moments and families on Instagram and things, and you're like, oh gosh, well, you know, and I'm not seeing the fallouts and the sulks and the tears.
But it's there. It's definitely there. I don't think that real thing exists where it's all perfect all the time. I don't think it does. Or someone that's completely across it all. I think it's actually quite nice when you know how to delegate. Delegating is an important thing.
Well, that's really difficult. But what's really interesting as well, at the older I've got anyway, is seeing how much of the influence of the patterns that you've been brought up within you that they are just so deeply instilled that it's really hard. Like, you know, the idea that to delegate or to get a nanny or a permanent member that helps you with housekeeping or something like that. I wasn't brought up that way, so it's really hard, because that's in my mind that's what the mum does, because that's a pattern that I was brought up with, and so it's really hard to undo that without thinking, oh no, but that's something. Oh, that, you know, it's always hard to give it up,
yes,
and to delegate and to say that can be a norm, or you can ask for help because it. You know, because you're not used to it. You've never considered it before.
No.
So it's really...
And also, you know, but if whatever, you know, the things you do, there's lots of stuff you get up to, and it all needs time and care and headspace. So, you know, you're the first person to live exactly your life. So you can't really copy and paste what happened before anyway, because that's a different person and a different set of, you know... All the variables were different. Was your mum a working
mum? And yet they have huge...
Did she work?
She was amazing, actually. She started going back to college to do a teaching course when she had four children and the youngest was three.
Wow.
And I know, when I think about it, and she was full-time mother of four, from 4 to 11, I think our ages were. And she did that course and then started working as a teacher. So I would have been... 16 when she went to work. So yeah, a little bit of both, yeah. Basically.
She probably did that because as well the hours could work quite well with you guys and being home in the evenings and in the morning a bit.
Yeah. Well, she's a pretty bright lady, and she got married very young and had children very young, and she brought up in a council estate, and I think she had the opportunity then to push her education, yeah. she ran with it, which is, I'm just so in awe of that.
Fantastic. And I guess if she's, you know, looking outside of herself like that, she's probably also, well, possibly a part of the reason why you're so into your books and reading and exploring. Do you think you got that a bit from your mum?
Yeah. Well, my mum, but also my dad. My dad's a huge influence. Like, my dad was kind of a beatnik.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for sure.
That's cool.
And, like, he loves Spain. He loved potholing.
Oh, wow.
I mean,
okay,
what's that all about?
I haven't tried it.
Potholing?
Maybe it's a whale of a time.
I'm now obsessed with, it's funny, my dad died about 2 years ago, and I'm now obsessed with reading books about exploration and mountaineering.
Oh, but you've done as well, haven't you? Haven't you done a bit of mountaineering?
Yeah. Yeah, I took my boys when they were 9 and 12, and we walked up to Everest Base Camp.
That's incredible. And what a trip.
Oh my gosh, if you fancy it, do it.
How long does it take?
And you can do it within, well, we took it quite slowly because obviously we had the youngsters with us, so we did it over 11 days, but you can do it faster than that. But honestly, it's if the slower you go, the better it is, because you have to adapt to altitude anyway. In fact, everyone else was fine. Mm-hmm. It was Muggins here who was like gung-ho, you know, I'm always wanting to go on adventures and do strange things for a break. Instead, I don't like beach holidays much, you know, it's not really for me, that's all. And the others are like, no, come on, let's chill. I'm like, no, let's do this. So it was my 50th. It was 3 years ago. So my 50th, my husband said, all right, then let's go. Let's go to Everest Base Camp and do that walk. And so I'm all like gung-ho. And it was me that had to slow down because I had altitude sickness.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were like laughing. So that just means that you have to stay in a village a bit longer.
Okay.
So then you zigzag up so that your body gets time to feel less oxygen in the air, and then you go back down and sleep down in a lower village, and then you go up again to the next village and then go a bit higher, but you sleep a bit lower, if you know what
yeah
I mean.
I didn't realize you did it like up. That I had no I presumed if you're climbing a mountain you just keep going up.
No.
So yeah, got it totally
and
wrong.
And you know, it's a trail, you don't get lost because it's a trail. And there was, like, at one point there was an 81-year-old walking the trail. Oh. So it's completely doable. And the best thing is that the Nepalese people really welcome you there, because they the economy is you know, needs the tourist dollar. And you know, all the talk about all the rubbish and stuff on Everest. Well, I didn't go up to the top, the heights. Besides which, they've been spending so much time and love on Everest to get recycling centres and keep it clear, and it's beautiful. So don't, if you're listening to this and you fancy doing it, do it. It's absolutely life changing.
And the kids weren't, they were good at just getting on with it and getting through all the walking and.
But they do it in chunks. So you do like on average about 2 or 3 hours in the morning, and then you stop and have chips for lunch.
Perfect.
if chips you want, or dal bhat, which is like lentils and rice,
yep.
or pizza. Yeah. And then you walk another 2 or 3 hours.
Amazing.
In the afternoon, there's one day where it was really, really a slog. Oh my gosh, it was such a slog. It was 9 hours. And that's to get up to the Namche Bazaar, which is the highest Sherpa village in the Himalaya on the way to Everest. And that was a slog. It was like, are we there yet? Even the adults were like, are we there yet? And the Sherpas would be like, yes, yes, almost there.
Wow.
But you wouldn't be almost there at all.
That's an amazing thing.
It was beautiful because you see all the juniper bushes and rhododendron forests. Basically, the terrain changes. Every few hours, the terrain changes and the weather changes. So you've got sometimes it's absolutely beautiful and bright and hot. And then sometimes it could be dark and grey and the cloudy. And then sometimes it'd be torrential monsoon rain. So, and then, you know, sometimes you'd be in jungle kind of thing and rainforest, and sometimes you'd be in complete like moonscapes. It's so, and then you see the Khumbu ice fall, like the glass, not the ice fall, but the glacier. So if you've never seen a glacier before, you're like, you know, like I've been reading all these books. So I'm like, oh my God, that's the Khumbu glacier.
Yeah.
And it's turquoise. And you can hear, if you like music or sounds, you can hear the dripping of the melting glacier and the little trickles of the rock creeks coming under the ice down the mountains, and you're just immersed in these beautiful sounds.
God, that sounds absolutely magical. And how nice to share it as a family like that and do something really special for a big birthday. That's actually very inspiring.
Yeah.
I might have to look at that. So, and sorry to skip a little, but I was thinking that as a musician, when people ask me if my kids are musical, I'm always a bit like, it's a bit of an obvious question. But given that you've grown up surrounded by music and Welsh culture is so much about song and singing without even really thinking about it, it's just a thing that happens in terms of like you're encouraged to do it. Like we don't have that so much in England. If you're singing, it's a bit of a like, oh, we're going to do a song now. But I think in Welsh culture, it's storytelling, it's family, it's all of that from when you're tiny. Is that something you have encouraged with your kids?
Yeah, well, I try to, but it's like, you know, I love the story of Tom Jones. He says he started singing when he was a babe in arms. But because can you imagine? It's not unusual to be a baby, give him a bottle to be loved by anyone.
Or just
shut
him
up,
like,
baby.
Wow. Like going from like wow into like a little like, whoa, yeah.
I love that. There's another kiss. Yeah.
So, put a bottle in it, Tom.
Isn't it? Oh, yeah. Make him shush now. It's something that is that you're so unself-conscious about it, because it's literally that's one of the most sort of valuable things I took out of my sort of culture and upbringing. But I brought up my children in West London, and apart from like filling the house with music
and instruments and stuff,
and they all love music. But then like, yeah, a lot of people ask about, you know, are your children musical? I think all children are musical.
Yeah, that's actually what I say as well.
They are music until they get self-conscious or they're taught that. So, because one of the most valuable things to me is the, you know, that the fact I went to chapel 3 times on a Sunday with
three
my mum.
3 times?
Yes, 3 times it used to be on a Sunday. And that was fine because we'd have orange squash and cakes. And other kids to play around with, so it was actually quite fun. But within that, there was all the singing and all the, and then if you get bored with a hymn, you could just sing your heart out and figure out all the harmonies, which is what I used to do. God knows what the bloody noise would have been like. I don't know, but anyway, I loved it. I was having fun, and Mum was happy because we'd come with her, yeah. You know. So anyway, I wanted to sort of be able to make sure that the children grew up and learn all this repertoire, yeah, without having to learn, yeah, it. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Just learn by osmosis, yeah. And my husband's Catholic, so their children went to school are going to school through the Catholic system, and the school happens to have one of the best choirs in the country. Wow. So they're not learning the Welsh hymns, alas, but they are learning, you know, Benjamin Britten and Mozart and ancient liturgy, and they're singing like Purcell in the shower. And this is a state school as well, and I'm so happy about that, because to learn by osmosis is much better than having to, having to do it forcibly.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for me with my kids, I don't mind what they do for a living at all, but I would love it if music was always a friend of theirs, because for me it's just been a place that I can always turn to no matter what's going on, and it gives me so much. It's like just such an amazing emotional outlet for me, music. So I would love it if they always have that friend in it too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's nothing better, is there? And you know, when you have a shared experience as well with music, like exactly what you do, but if you've got a playlist, I mean, I like Jimmy Smith, at Christmas, Louis Armstrong, Mahalia Jackson, Jimmy Smith, all of these, Nat King Cole, yep, Ella Fitzgerald, you bring them out and gosh, talk about packaging up life in such a splendid padded cushion. Yeah. It's amazing what music does.
And it joins the dots of all the other times you've heard them as well. It's like a little loop through time, which I think is really, really, yeah, magical. Yeah. Well, I'm really conscious of your time. I've only got a couple more things to ask you. One of them is, are you the sort of mother that you thought you would be?
Probably not. definitely not the mother I wanted to be, you know, because I'm also really, I love working as well. I think I realised that quite quickly. I love my babies. I love them so much, but also loved having that space and peace to be able to keep driving inside, you know, music and writing and art. so yeah, I think we're brought up thinking that we should be the happy all the time mum that is always there, that is fat and cuddly and cooks great bread and cheesy whatever lasagna and things, always ready and always understanding and always patient and never shouts. And I'm definitely not that mum.
No.
You know, I was baking sourdough in lockdown like a million people and getting a bit obsessed with that, but that's dead, long dead.
the mother in the fridge,
my sourdough stuff is long. I've got a little bit in the freezer.
That's that what I'm, Richard
you
did.
Know, does it work? What's it called when you freeze, you know, Austin Power, like,
you know what? I just
cyber freeze.
I don't know, and I just kept getting confused every time he talked about the mother in the fridge. I was just, it just.
Well, my mother's in the freezer.
I think
right
we've
now,
got a couple of mothers.
I think
in there.
I could.
Yeah, we had the sourdough, yeah, though, the same thing. I don't know if that mother exists. I think that really eternally wholesome patient. I aspire, but I don't hit my targets very often with that, yeah, either.
You can't win. You can't win either, because if you're too soft, you said, oh, well, you're not disciplining them enough. They need structure. If you're too hard, oh, you're too hard. I'm like, oh, God, you can't win. You're like, well, what the hell am I meant to be doing? I think basically by the time you learn how to become the best parent you can be, the children are like in the
Yes.
They're about to leave the home. They've
but
left.
Then you also realise that.
And you're like, hang on a minute, come back,
yeah, yeah,
I've
come
worked
back.
It out.
Can we rehash come some back. Of those previous conversations we had at the moment? I'm feeling in the right mood for it,
yeah,
now.
Exactly.
I know, but I think I did read exactly. something that said, you know, good enough is good. That does work. And I think also, just, you know, as you get older, you know, you look at your own parents and you see them in 360, and you could, you know, if they were this sort of like very neat version of a parent when you were small, you might get older and then realize, oh, but what did they have for themselves? And actually, that's the bit where you can build on for the next bit. Like, that's really special. You kind of want them to be having, you want your parents to have a life outside of just being your parent. Otherwise, what happens when you, when you're not there? Like, that can probably be tricky too.
And that nobody can be perfect, which actually brings us right back to where we started, back to Dylan Thomas, which is all about warts and all.
Yes.
Like, nobody is
absolutely
perfect. So there's a bit in it that the Reverend Eli Jenkins says. Hang on, if you bear with me while I find out, I'm at the beginning.
No, you find it. I've got my book here too.
I want to find
in front of me.
Okay, so this is it's a beautiful song, for one, from Under Milkwood. It's Reverend Eli Jenkins, and he's reciting this as dusk arrives in the little village, and they're all getting ready for the night ahead and to settle down into to the next night's sleep. So at the doorway of Bethesda House, the Reverend Jenkins recites to Llareggub Hill, his sunset poem. We are not wholly bad or good who live our lives under Milkwood. And thou, I know, will be the first to see our best side, not our worst. Or let us see another day. Bless us all this night, I pray. And to the sun we all will bow and say goodbye, but just for now.
My word, that's pretty perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful story.
It really is.
So that's... And it's what's lovely about it as well, it's, as I said, it's quite naughty as well. So there's a few pub scenes, because obviously in Under Milkwood there's loads of characters that you would, you know, one would recognise from wherever you live. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got womanizers, you've got drunkards, you've got the hard workers, you've got the ones that don't want to work at all. You've got the neat freak, you've got the dreamers, you've got everyone in there. The older generation, the younger generation, and you've got the ones that, you know, find a little too much solace in the bottle of a bottle. And then you've got this scene. So Cherry Owen is one example of the characters that does drink rather a lot, too much, in fact. As we can hear from this scene, this again is dusk time. So Cherry Owen, sober as Sunday, as he is every day of the week, goes off happy as Saturday to get drunk as a deacon, as he does every night. Evening, Cherry. Evening, Sinbad. What'll you have? Too much. Shh. So the narrator goes, shh. Dusk is drowned forever until tomorrow. It is all at once night now. And then it goes on. Anyway, gorgeous. So no, it's tremendous. I'm so excited about hearing stories about people who are reading this story to their children for the first time. Yeah. I mean, this is the whole point of this book, is to introduce a new, fresh blood to the story, and to see what they make of it and what bits they love. There's a fish sleeping in the sea that needs to be found by a toddler as well. So yeah, let me know what your youngest.
I will definitely do that. I will give you some feedback. And in the meantime, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book, and I look forward to hearing all the shows that you are currently putting together. They will be in our kitchen over the next few weeks. And
well, I hope you approve, Sophie, and thanks so much for the time as well.
Yeah, same here.
And a lovely chat.
I will say goodbye, but just for now. See what I mean? How lovely is that? Yeah, it's so nice to talk to Keris and catch up and think about the parallels, but also what an interesting life, and that bit of living on our own in the cabin. I mean, golly, I can imagine that's quite a formative experience. But then once you've come the other side of it and you're sort of 20 years on and you're in your family home with all your teenagers around you, it must feel like a very strange sort of memory, like a dream you had once. But I also think it's so brave to do things like that. Sometimes we need to do things like that. I've never really been brave enough, I don't think, always surrounding myself with people. In fact, when I was a kid, I always thought I'd live in another country for a while, and I just never did. I think that's probably one of the things I would have liked to have done. I mean, I know I'm lucky enough to travel, but I literally live 10 minutes from the house I grew up in. Well, from when I was 10. And the house where I grew up is only another 10 minutes away from the area I grew up when I was before that. So I haven't really been too bold in that regard. Anyway,
that's what happened to me, and I'm happy with that. And yeah, I hope the rest of your day goes all right, or if you're listening to me at night, I hope I've soothed you to slumber. You're probably fast asleep by now. I'm going to make an attempt to get on with the rest of my to-do list, which I don't normally write it down, but I had to today because there's just things that I can't put off till tomorrow. So yeah, going to go and tackle all that and hopefully have some replies from all my many, many emails I sent out yesterday and the day before for nice, amazing, lovely guests to introduce you to or for you to hear more from. And in the meantime, actually, I don't want to boast, but I'm sat in the room I often speak to you from, which is my four-year-old son bedroom / my dressing room. So I'm surrounded by clothes, which has made it inadvertently a very good room for sound because I've basically deadened any sort of like extra audio by surrounding myself with like tons and tons of clothing. But I've also been going through like organizing my drawers and stuff. Have you been doing any of that? It's almost like I've gone into like a spring cleaning mode, but in January. I've even done things like go through all my tights. All my tights, like I know where all the tights are. Like if I want a pattern tight, if I want a black opaque, I know where everything is now. All my pants are in a certain place. My socks, my bras. I mean, maybe you live like this anyway, but I was a bit more shambolic. And I've gone through all my jumpers and my jeans and my t-shirts. I know you're probably like, big wow, that's what I do anyway. But for me, this is another step towards adulthood. Anyway, I want a pat on the back and I want you to keep me going because I don't know about you, but when I'm in a mood to organise and sort, I've just got to leap on that because before I know it, I will regress back to my natural lazy state. And as I say that sentence, my eyes rested on a huge pile of clothes on a chair opposite me that I haven't bothered with for at least a week. So maybe that's on my to-do list as well. And thank you as always for lending me your ears. I hope you have a really lovely rest of your week. And I will bring you another sparkling guest next week. Lots of love. See you soon. Bye.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.